Take a network break, steep a nice hot cup of tea, visualize the perfect virtual donut, and join us as we wade into this week's sea of angst, posturing, and obfuscation. I'm your host, Drew Conry Murray, and joining me as always is Greg Farrow. Greg, how you doing?
Not too bad. It's been a week of returning to normal life, and it's been a bumpy road. Just haven't been able to get the sleep I need for some reason. Not sure why, but there you go.
All right, there it is. I hope you're wide awake for this. Before we jump into the episode, I want to thank today's sponsor. This week's episode of Network Break is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. This week's show is also sponsored by Nuage Networks from Nokia. These network experts bring the power of the cloud to your data center and WAN network. Connect across any cloud, any network, and any hardware in any form factor. Partner with Nuage Networks to move your business into the next era of network freedom. Okay, jumping into the news, we have a lot of Cisco to talk about. It recently released its quarterly earnings, and the tech press has also pulled some interesting tidbits out of Chuck Robbins' call with the analysts, particularly around Cisco's move toward more subscription pricing and how the company views the white box threat. We'll dig into those, but first we want to look at just some of the financial performance numbers. So apparently Cisco beat the street with its 2016 Q3 earnings report, came in at 57 cents a share versus the market prediction of 55 cents a share, so well done, Cisco.
Yeah, Cisco's got an astonishing talent to always hit the numbers. I always sit there and question just how astonishing it is that Cisco cares more about shareholders than it would appear to do than customers. Because if it really cared about customers, it would do more to make sure their products were awesome and that they had salespeople. But what Cisco actually does is make sure that it meets the shareholders' requirements first and then customers come second. And that's the conclusion I'm slowly drawing from their astonishing, excellent performance. Right? You've got to remember that Juniper's down. We'll talk more about Brocade in a bit. They're down. F5's in a hole because people don't believe there's any growth. The analysts are saying that even though Cisco has definitely under threat, like there's headwinds against them, they're growing into adjacent markets. They're acquiring new businesses and making new market segments for them to get revenue from. And they're able to keep and sustain the existing market, so they're not losing a whole lot of business, although they are. We'll talk about that in a minute. Uh-huh. Things are going pretty badly, though, in the enterprise IT section.
Well, let's look at a few of the numbers. The company reported $12 billion in revenue for the quarter. That's a pretty tidy sum. However, switch sales were down 3%, routing dropped 5%. Where they did see growth was in collaboration, which was up 10%, and security, which was up 17%. That's pretty good.
So the numbers are there that Cisco is, of course, the top-selling network security vendor in the world by a significant margin, far larger than Palo or Check Point or Fortinet. Mm-hmm. I was reading some research papers this week. I should have captured those numbers, but I didn't. The thing to remember here is that Cisco bought Sourcefire to bolster their security division, which has always had a bit of a mixed story.
Right.
So they spent over $5 billion to buy Sourcefire. So they need that growth to justify that expenditure. So good to see that security is actually making headway.
Yeah, although if you look at the revenues for this quarter, it was less than $500 million in security versus $5.3 billion in the switching and routing biz. So still pretty lopsided, although Cisco does love growth, so I'm sure they're happy to see those numbers go up.
That's right. Well, you know, $12 billion in revenue is 4% or 5% less year on year, so it's 5% less than it was a year ago. The reason that the street is actually excited about that is because Cisco did better than they told the street they were going to, or the general consensus. Everybody thought Cisco would drop a little bit, like most of the people in the market, and Cisco hasn't done that, which is, you know, a very all-round great effort. But what I will draw your attention to is I was reading a research document from Jefferies, and his exact comments were that four times in the last 12 years, Cisco felt pressure on profit margins. They were each followed by a reduction in headcount of between 2 to 15% and other sorts of cost reductions. In total, Cisco's ability to manage through economic softness is significant. And what we're seeing, of course, is that Cisco's already announced several rounds of headcount reductions in the last 12 months. As they continue to try and sustain their shareholder commitments and make sure that shareholders are getting a suitable dividend and that there's, you know, good profits on shrinking revenue, they're going to keep reducing headcount. They're going to be start reducing products, which we've got more on that in a minute. They are actually starting to exit products. And, you know, the threats that are around them, they are definitely doing things to combat them, but they're not doing enough, I think.
So let's talk a little bit about one of the things Cisco is doing. A story from Recode talking about Cisco planning to bring a more to emphasize more subscription pricing model, perhaps even for switch sales, which maybe would include a cloud management element. And the idea behind subscription models is that it, you know, helps smooth out that revenue stream instead of sort of the boom and bust cyclical nature of hardware sales.
Not only does it smooth it out, it actually earns them a hell of a lot more money.
That's right.
If you work out, I don't know if you've ever looked at subscription pricing, but it does actually work out to be financially very strong. The challenge with subscription pricing is you've got a cash flow problem. You can't go into it too hard or you lose money. So what I'm saying is if you're buying $1 million worth of Nexus 7000s today and suddenly you shift that and you when on the day the customer buys it, you recognize that revenue. Well, in Cisco's case, the day it ships out of a warehouse somewhere, they recognize that revenue. But that revenue is then recognized and they book that and so forth and so on. If you shift that from $1 million one-off purchase and the customer uses it for however long to, I don't know, $100,000 a year, $200,000 a year, mm-hmm. Well, all of a sudden you've got $800,000 worth of missing cash flow in year one.
Yes.
So you want customers to shift to subscription revenue because you'll charge more and get more out of it in the long run, but you don't want too many of them there because otherwise you'll have revenue shrinking ahead of getting the money back in years' time.
Right. You got to manage that transition so that you don't suddenly look like you've lost all of your business.
That's right. The second thing about subscription pricing is it's very expensive to sustain. That is, your costs of sustaining subscription pricing is very high because you've got hardware on a customer site. Your salespeople have to go out and provide white glove. The cost of salespeople to go out there and maintain those contracts and keep them up to date is very high. But customers don't tend to leave you. Once they're stuck in the enterprise IT, things don't change. Cisco is, in effect, locking customers in. They're building a moat around their business that makes it hard for customers to change away. Instead of going into the once every 10 years replacing my core switch and then having a bake-off and customers make a decision, they can now start to just roll it. Mm-hmm. If you're not saying, they can start to get in. Now, this isn't new, this idea of subscription pricing for hardware. We can talk about subscription pricing for other things in a minute. But these types of models have been in place for 20 years. I've been working, Cisco has a finance department, so do most of the other companies. Brocade's been doing a subscription pricing model or a per-port pricing model, which
That's
is
right.
effectively subscription for hardware. Mm-hmm. Extreme talked to us last week at Interop about their pricing model for the same sort of thing.
Yeah, and so did Huawei, that they're adding a sort of cloud management layer that becomes a subscription revenue as you buy the hardware.
That's right. So in that sense, Cisco isn't leading the market with subscription pricing. I don't think it wants to do subscription pricing. I think it's being forced to because financially it doesn't make sense. Customers are moving to the cloud. Some customers, and enough of them, are moving to the cloud because they want to avoid the CapEx spending. They can't afford, you know, companies who are poor can't afford a bit of money to buy IT. And so they're coming up with ways to make their products more attractive to those customers, but their competitors are already there.
That's
and
right.
sometimes years ago. So in that sense, it's not exactly a Cisco innovation. It's following where the market's going, I suppose.
Absolutely, and that's
now,
how Cisco plays
it. Yeah, that said, keep in mind there are other places where subscriptions make very good sense, which is, say, the SourceFire firewalls with the malware and the cloud engines.
Mm-hmm.
They bring in a Talos threat security feed or look at what they've done with Ironport for the malware scanning for web traffic and for email. Those are subscription businesses in the security. And, you know, they're coming into their fourth year, and I'm sure the revenues coming out of those businesses are getting stronger and stronger for those web services appliances and mail service appliances.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're getting attracted to that because it's starting to really work wonders. Very cheap to run those services in the cloud. And, you know, the acquisition of OpenDNS a while ago starts to feed in intelligence information into those services. So it all starts to come together.
Right. And they also, with the acquisition of Meraki, which was the cloud WLAN, also sort of brings that subscription idea into the networking side of the business as well, outside of security and collaboration.
Yeah, I think the success of the Meraki model is that customers can't get away from you. They can't forget you between times, if you know what I'm saying. So,
well, sure, because every 3 months you send them a bill.
Yeah, well, and there's that, but you're also logging into their cloud platform all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the cloud platform is constantly changing stuff for you and updating you and getting in your face with advertising and all that sort of stuff. Whereas normally we just log into a CLI and you don't see any banner ads or, you know, whatever. The only time you deal with the company is when you've got pain, and that's tech support. And tech support's degrading as companies, you know, as companies like Cisco. And Cisco's not the only one with the degrading tech support. It's across the board. Tech support is degrading because companies are being forced to give their shareholders money. And so they're extracting, you know, costs out of tech support, making the products less, have more bugs as they try and salvage the, you know, the profit, the bottom line. You've got to do that, by the way. It's not a criticism. I'm just saying don't have high expectations that things are going to get better. As money tightens up, a lot of things are going to have to change.
So speaking of change, another issue that Cisco is facing is white boxes. And Mitch Wagner at Light Reading picked up on a comment from Chuck Robbins around white box, which is saying that customers aren't drawn to white box because of the technology, but because they see it solving a business problem, particularly keeping costs down and driving greater automation. And I really think that's a perceptive analysis. I think, you know, Chuck Robbins has it right there. But his response to Cisco and how it would address that challenge didn't really seem to match. Mitch writes, Cisco addresses the white box threat by building products that meet those business needs, including improved ASICs for better price performance. And I thought, like, no, that doesn't seem right. ASICs and white box just...
I don't think so. I think the impact of white box is silent. We don't see it in public because the people who are buying white box don't get up on a soapbox and talk about buying white box, and nobody's marketing engine is out there talking about buying white box. And those people out there who are buying Pika 8, who's doing, you know, for example, or Penguin or any of the others, like even Supermicro starting to produce a line of white box switches, which they're shipping. You don't hear people talking about that. And I think that the impact of white box is much greater. Cisco has already met the white box threat in one way by using a merchant silicon and producing its own white box in the Nexus 9000 product line. Mm-hmm. It's not white box, but it's very white box-like. Cheap hardware, lots of software on top, and then, you know, subscription revenue coming from Cisco ACI, of course. And building better ASICs, most people actually don't need better ASICs. The vast majority of the market don't need ASICs that do, you know, the last 5%. What they just need is a choice for cheaper products sometimes. And I think increasingly customers are opting for cheap instead of features.
Well, price is certainly part of it, but what they also need is, you know, the ability to scale out management and operations a little more easily. And that's something that one of the promises of Whitebox is that you start to manage your switching infrastructure more like you manage your server infrastructure, with more automation, more scripting, and so on. And I really haven't seen Cisco outside of ACI sort of move in that direction. And, you know, managing Whitebox is a little bit, you know, smaller bite to take off than a whole ACI forklift upgrade. So I think they still need to do some work there.
I guess what you're saying there is Cisco's been slow to embrace the open movement, like, you know, getting Puppet agents and Chef and supporting Ansible. And although they've got it that there are parts of Cisco that are actually producing that code, I would suggest to you that the bulk of Cisco has yet to embrace open source and open tooling and operations and management and stuff like that. In fact, sometimes they just outright obstreperously, like, there's so many business units in Ethernet switches, like 5,000, 6,000, 3,000, 4,000, there's 9,000s, there's, you know, some of the business units are embracing it, but most of them aren't. They don't want to see their revenue walk out the door. And why are they developing all this extra, you know, why are they diverting funds into developing these features that they don't want to develop?
Right, right. Yeah, so they've still got some work to do. Okay, we've got one more Cisco story for this episode. The Register has a story out that Cisco's going to stop selling the Nexus 6000 switches by mid-2017.
Yeah, the Nexus 6000, I must remember when it came out, I can remember clearly sitting in Cisco Live talking to the Cisco Nexus 6000 product manager going, I have no idea why this product exists.
Wow.
And I went out and spoke to some other people in the reseller community, and they went, we have no idea why we want this. But they've been out there for a few years. Now, the product's been end of life. Cisco's now recommending that customers move to the Nexus 5000, specifically the 5600 product line. It shares the same silicon, but it was basically a chassis-based version of the Nexus 5000, if I understand it. And it was largely focused on producing 40 and 100 gig spines for Nexus 5000 switches, which, you know what, most people just don't need that many switching ports. And if I'm going to do it, the Nexus 9000 is going to work out pretty fine at a fraction of the price of a Nexus 6000. So I did a feature match on the Nexus 6000 once, and there's not much in there that stands out. Not when you've got the 7000 on the other side, the Cat 4000, 45, you know, the Cat 4000 family on the other side. Why does this product exist? So it dying is not a surprise. And as I just alluded to earlier, the financial pressures that Cisco's under to maintain its profit margins and try and keep revenue up, the fastest way to maintain profit is to start cutting products and cutting headcount. Mm-hmm. So here's your evidence that that's starting to bite inside of Cisco.
Yeah, and I think you know, a 40 gig move also sort of got sidelined by the emergence of the 25, 50, 100 developments that made 40 seem a little bit out of place.
Oh, definitely. The cost of the 25/50 gig Ethernet standards, they're talking now that 25 gig pricing in 2017 will be just maybe 30 to 50% more than a 10 gig. And by 2018, your servers, data center servers, will be 25 gig of standard because it's cheap. Uh-huh. Provided the IEEE can finally get around. They didn't ratify it last month. They've been saying it's been on the agenda for final ratifications for over 7 months now. And every meeting, there's another reason they spend 8 hours talking about stuff and never get a ratified standard out. I read the minutes for the last one. It's amazing. But I agree, you know, the technology inside the 6000 would need to be respun for the 2550/100 using the modern standards. The 100 gig CLR4 CWDM4 debate still hasn't been solved yet. And Cisco's looking at that going, oh, blah, 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 blah. It's cheaper just to throw it in the bin and start again.
That's right.
I get all that money back. Get rid of that headcount, put them in the bin, take the product line, put that in the bin, and then switch products and increase volume on the products that I've got, and then get greater profit margins because I'm scaling up those production lines.
So we'll have a link to the end-of-life note from Cisco in our show notes, but just a couple of dates if you're a 6000 customer. They're going to stop issuing software maintenance releases by April of 2018. They're going to stop supporting the software entirely in 2020 and stop supporting the hardware in 2022. So there's your end dates.
Yeah, my sense is that there'll be more of this. The Nexus 6000 won't be the first product to go. There's plenty more coming. And also expect reductions in sales and engineering and tech and across the board. I'd expect several thousand more jobs to go in the months ahead.
All right. Let's take a quick sponsor break. This episode is brought to you by IT Pro TV. And Greg, can you tell us a little bit about what folks can get from IT Pro TV?
IT Pro TV is a training program for your IT certifications, and in fact, it's useful for just general skills. Courses are streamed live to your favorite device, Chromecasts, Fire TVs, Apple TVs, or just use your mobile phone wherever you are. Course topics include CompTIA, Advanced Security Practitioner, Ethical Hacking, Cryptography, Metasploit, and much more. With IT Pro TV, you get over 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs and transcender practice exams. So if you're somebody who's facing down the product, the prospect of recertifying or maybe going into one of your certifications, vendor certifications for the first time, practice exams are a great way to reduce the nerves if you haven't sat an exam since high school. One low monthly subscription price, no hassle cancellation policy, and you should get into it. Have a look and see if you think it's worthwhile doing.
Yeah, so check out itpro.tv/networkbreak to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions, they're normally $57 a month or $570 a year, but there's a special offer for our listeners. You can try it for free for 7 days when you sign up using our code NETWORKBREAK30 to check out their courses, the live stream, and more. You'll also get 30% off the lifetime of your account, so that's less than $40 a month or $399 for the entire year. And thanks to IT Pro TV for sponsoring Network Break. Okay, jumping back into the news, Network World has an article about platform as a service vendor Aprenda acquiring a startup that produces a commercial version of Kubernetes, which we all know is the open source container orchestration platform that came out of Google. The thrust of this article is that containers are kind of becoming enterprise ready. They're not there yet. And Greg, you and I had recently talked about Gartner dismissing OpenStack as a science project. Are we still in the science project phase of containers, at least when it comes to the enterprise?
I think so, although you might use it in ways that you don't expect, which is Aprenda is a PaaS platform, not a Docker, not a container company, if you like, in the same way. And the other significant PaaS platform was Cloud Foundry that we talked about last week too.
Yes, pivotal.
And largely, you don't actually want to know about containers, and you don't actually care. You shouldn't need to know about Kubernetes. You shouldn't need to know about containers. What you should have is something where you have developers writing code. They click a button, and suddenly it's running in a test environment, and somehow those scripts are running, you know, or those apps have been compiled, checked into a continuous integration, continuous delivery pipeline, and then suddenly deployed into something. Who cares if it's a VM or a container or a mystical fairy pocket, you know, that's covered in glitter? It doesn't really matter. It runs, the tests all run, and then if it's the code passes it all, then it goes straight off into a production environment as well. great, right? That's the goal of containers, is that you don't have to think about, I'm writing code, I need to deploy it, I have to make a query for a VM, the VM needs networking and storage and blah, blah, blah. That's all, that's what's got to be changed. So for PaaS vendors to buy Kubernetes is kind of like saying, our customers are telling us that they want Kubernetes and containers, so we'll add it to our PaaS platform, so they shut up.
Do you think it's customers asking for Kubernetes or customers saying, I need some way to keep track of all this and make all of that magic happen in the background so that my developers and my operations team can just press buttons and keep an eye on things?
I think people feel that, you know, using Kubernetes is going to be like using a standard. If you're in an enterprise, you want to be able to draw on a pool of people. You want to hire developers who know how to run something. And if you're using Apprenda or Cloud Foundry, you're not necessarily going to be able to go and hire Cloud Foundry developers, if you know what I'm saying. So if you're saying, we have a PaaS that uses Kubernetes that runs on Docker, you've just ticked all the boxes in the tender. Because you're using all the the pseudo standards.
The de factos,
So my guess would be is that, and then it also, maybe they can get some customers using, you know, sell some customers their commercial version of Kubernetes, which is called Kismatic, and then you can upsell them to the PaaS later on. So it could be as much of a customer generation from bottom up as it is from the top down. And you know what? They need some way to orchestrate their containers. Why not use Kubernetes?
All right. So another new story, checking in on the Dell EMC merger. Dell just issued a $20 billion bond as part of its effort to finance the deal.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of money. It'd be interesting to see if they get it away. The only reason this will be a story is if it fails.
Well, no, it's actually, it's gotten a pretty good response so far from the market. People, I just worry about the debt that Dell/EMC is piling on itself as it tries to birth this baby.
Well, increasingly, either Dell's going to, the whole deal EMC thing looks like it's going to be a spectacular success, or it's going to burn and turn and burn all the way down. Because when you load it up with that much debt, if anything goes wrong, you're going to be, you know, they have to make, I mean, the debt, the bond is pretty highly priced, though, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, yeah. We talked about this before. There's like a 10% return or something on that, which is astonishing.
Right.
No wonder everybody's piling in.
Right. That's a lot of laptops you have to sell.
Yeah, that's a lot of laptops in a market where laptops aren't selling very well.
Right.
Right. And enterprise IT revenue shrinking at 5% per quarter. Like, you know, we've seen Cisco, Brocade, you know, EMC all talk about shrinking revenues at 2 to 5% per quarter. You've either got to get a lot more sales somehow. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. Or you've got to get a lot of savings out of merging the two companies together to make those products cheaper without your price being eroded. But at the same time, everybody's, you know, there's a significant amount of revenue moving to cloud. There's a significant amount of revenue moving to converged systems. You know, blah, blah, blah. I'm not 100% sure. Like we did a podcast this week with a customer of VMware who's running a 1,000-person company fundamentally on 8 servers. And that includes the VDI and all the servers they need to run their apps.
Wow.
And their DMZs and all their security tooling.
Mm.
8 servers. So
somewhere Michael Dell is crying out in pain.
Yeah, I just don't know. Like, you know, that's, and the money there is not in Dell's pocket. It went to VM. Most of the money's been captured not in hardware, but in software, in the VMware licensing stuff that goes on the top of that one.
Right.
If that's a harbinger, if that's a sign of the future, you know, 8 servers to run an entire VDI and app and firewall, email gateways, security gateways, and all that sort of stuff. You know, just how are they going to make money out of that? I'm not sure that I can see it. But I'm sure they're smarter than me. They've got more information for sure.
Well, they certainly have more information. Whether or not they're smarter, that's a question for another day. But they're certainly taking a big gamble. And I feel like we've been talking about the Dell-EMC merger for about 100 years now and just waiting for this thing to actually happen. The official line is that it was the official close of the acquisition will be sometime between May and October. But a site called Channelnomics is reporting that Michael Dell is aiming to actually have the acquisition closed in mid-July. So we'll see maybe if this summer we actually can move on.
Yep. I mean, you know, it can only go two ways. It can either be a huge success or it's going to burn because of the debt burden that it's got to burn through. And they continue to sell off business units. You know, there's been a constant story about it. But you've got to believe these people know what they're doing. So, you know, I'm expecting a big success somehow.
All right, we'll see. Okay, a story about VCE and VxRail. The Register's reporting that VCE's hyperconverged offering, which is called VxRail, sold 146 units in just over a month and a half. And the company is predicting that it's going to overtake the hyperconvergence leader Nutanix by the end of the year. Is this executive bold talk, or do you think they actually have a shot?
It sounds more like bold talk than anything practical. I mean, Nutanix has got years of customer attraction and reference sites. EMC, of course, has got its name and its reputation. Hard to see who'll win. I wonder how many of these customers for these new hyperconverged appliances are actually switching away from the converged platforms of VBlocks. Mm. And is that destructive to the business?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm looking for something smaller than a VBlock, maybe this VxRail is what I want, and it's actually reducing dependency on the VBlock that VCEs have been selling. It could be being a little selective with the truth, and certainly EMC executives are very good at emphasizing the things that are working for them, but I think overall they're going to struggle.
And you just mentioned, where is Dell going to replace all these server sales? In this story, there's also talk that Dell is going to move Quanta out of VxRail and be the compute portion for the VxRail. But the VCE VBlocks themselves are probably going to stick with Cisco blades and chassis for the VBlocks.
Yeah, well, that's what customers, they're paying a premium price, and then paying a premium on top of the premium price for the integration of those vendors together,
mm-hmm.
to remove that to remove the worry of interoperability and to simplify the buying decisions that they've made for themselves. I can see that that would tend to suggest that the hyperconverged should be targeted at an audience that wants something more price sensitive.
Yeah,
they want a cost effective product rather than willing to pay anything to get what is perceived to be value. That is the Hermes handbag thing. I want a Hermes handbag because it's a Hermes handbag, not because it's better or, it might actually be physically better, but I want the brand and the safety of that brand and the company that represents as much as I want the product. But there's also customers out there who customers who want choices away from premium products. And maybe that's where they're going to take VxRail's hyperconverged platform is into that price sensitive market.
They just need a bag to hold their stuff.
Yeah, who knows? Difficult times. I mean, VCE's got to be, going through an awful lot of uncertainty. They must be working hard to make those sales.
Mm-hmm.
EMC and Cisco at each other's throats. EMC merging with Dell. Who's going to come together? VMware is kind of like trying to be independent, but it's tied intimately to. It must be really difficult business to run.
It's super
challenging business.
Very challenging. Mm. But luckily, it will generate lots of more interesting news stories for us. Hey. Good for us. All right, another quick break to talk about our other sponsor for today, Nuage Networks. At Nuage Networks, they know you're counting on cloud services to move faster, cut costs, and deliver better services to your end users. Nuage overcomes limitations with today's rigid data center networks and provides SDN policy-based automation to drive your business at cloud speed. And that's all while addressing one of the biggest challenges in networking today, creating a seamless environment from the data center to the WAN and the branch office. Customers are realizing the benefits. Nuage Networks let you connect across any cloud and any application every time, and the constraints on your network disappear. Your data center network's lightning fast and flexible, just like your virtual compute platforms. It gives you new freedom and control when you connect cloud data centers and branch locations, and your end users get instant access to their applications anytime, anywhere. To find out how Nuage Networks is helping the cloud come of age, go to nuagenetworks.net, check out their blog at nuagenetworks.net/blog, and join the cloud conversation on Twitter using @NuageNetworks, and you'll find all those links in the show notes. Thanks, Nuage, for being a sponsor. Okay, so more stories. We've been watching Oracle and Google battle it out in court. Here's a little update. In San Francisco, both sides have presented their cases, and as we publish this podcast, the jury will start to hear closing arguments on Monday of next week.
It's been hysterical, hasn't it? You and I have been following Twitter accounts who've been tweeting live from the courtroom.
Yeah, reporters tweeting live.
What did you say a minute ago? The nerds have been meeting the real world or something?
Yeah, I read an article. I'll see if I can find the link. But somebody was just chuckling about how the nerds are finally running into the normals. And it's the normals who are in the positions of power casting judgment on the nerds. And they really don't know how to handle it.
Yes, it's hysterical. Things like, what's an API? Like, try and explain an API to a normal human who doesn't, live in a technology-centric world or something like that. And it's been hysterical. And Oracle and Google have been going at it nuts and hammer and nails, hammer and tongs.
Mm. Yeah, it's the stakes of the case are really big. It's all around Google's use of Java APIs in creating Android and whether they violated fair use rules or not. And if Oracle comes out on top, you know, with a verdict that Google did, I've heard reports that Oracle may ask for as much as $9 billion in damages.
And there was a really funny exchange where they were saying, how do you get to $9 billion? Oh, because every phone has built-in advertising. So we want a share of all the advertising revenue generated from the phones. Like on every web browser. Because like, Google made money from that, and that's our software, so we want all of that too. It's just
that's crazy.
Like, you know, we're gonna go stupid here. You know, we might as well, and like the legal system often allows stupid.
It sometimes does. But it's been interesting to read, you know, reports and transcripts of, you know, executives and technical folks trying to explain things to the judge and the lawyers and just having wonderful misunderstandings.
Oh, yeah. But still, I mean, you copywriting an API that you've never written, like that before you've even written it, it just has huge ramifications for the whole internet. If Oracle gets away with this.
It's true.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of outcome, like negative outcome at a business level. And at a more practical level, customers are really going to hate Oracle because they're going to have to do stuff that they don't want to do. For no value, by the way.
Sure.
Effectively, you know, if you think that Oracle suddenly owns a copyright on APIs generally, where are we then?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the repercussions of this case, despite the delight we're getting from the clash of cultures, is significant.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, we'll see what happens. Keep your fingers crossed, everybody. Let's hope that the jury in San Francisco knows what they're doing.
Yes, indeed.
All right, it is financial reporting season, and Greg, you've got some news on Brocade's results.
Yeah, Brocade announced this week they had a bad week too, like but unlike Cisco, they didn't actually show that their forward-looking results are good. A key part of why Cisco's share price didn't drop and actually popped by 3% was because they didn't predict soft results. Brocade, on the other hand, is guiding a Q3 revenue down at $510 to $530 million, which is well below what was previously predicted. They've basically been saying that SAN product revenue is down by 3.5 to 7% quarter on quarter in the next quarter, and that IP product revenue will pick up thanks to a stronger demand in America. Brocade's very strong in American government, apparently, and so they're subject to cyclical trends inside of those markets, especially and also in service providers. So if service providers stop buying and the federal government in America stops buying, Brocade's IP sales, that is switches and Ethernet and routers, they tend to get hit. Because Brocade didn't do good results in those, they're well down. They're down about 3 or 4% today. I think the main thing here is that Fibre Channel is dying quicker than people expected. And that's not a good sign for Brocade.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to continue to ride it out because it's even as it shrinks, it's still a profitable business, but it doesn't help their quarterly reports to watch those numbers go down.
I think it's the other thing too here is that Brocade keeps pointing to the next generation of Fibre Channel, the 32 gig, which they have a marketing name for called Gen 6, and they've been saying for the last two or three quarters, Gen 6 is going to, you know, sales of 32 gig are going to save us. It's going to pick up and we'll get more revenue. And it just hasn't happened. And I question whether there is actually any demand or, you know, like sustained demand or widespread demand for 32 gig. I think most people are just switching out for alternative forms of storage, you know, iSCSI, NFS, you know, different form. They're rolling their own storage arrays now instead of buying vendor storage arrays. I'm not sure that you can say that Gen 6 will, you know, sustain Fibre Channel revenue going forward.
Right, right. Well, people still buy tape, so who knows?
Yeah, tape's a different thing, though. There are definitely, if you're storing terabytes, you know, hundreds of terabytes of data, you can't put it onto CD-ROM. You know,
well, that's true. That is a different use case, yes, for long-term cold storage. Tape makes a lot of economic sense.
Long-term cold storage, emergency recovery, point-in-time storage. Tape will probably have a life of some sort until it goes the way of vinyl and then all of a sudden have a resurgence because of the hipsters.
Yes. I only store on tape, man. Quality's so much better.
That's right. I mean, I do. Tape is an interesting one. It's a very ephemeral media, but it's the only thing that can store the volume that you need.
Yeah.
And it's portable. It can be carried off site. What are you going to do? Start carrying storage arrays off to a storage facility offsite, you know, tapes make a lot more sense. You can get a lot of data on a tape. And the new generations of tape, I sat through a presentation from a tape company, and the logic is impeccable. You need a backup. You need to have this much data, and you need to be able to put it in a box and carry it offsite. There is no answer other than to put it on tape. You can make a copy of it in the cloud if you've got a small amount of data, but if you're trying to back up 50 terabytes or 100 terabytes, you need so much bandwidth, it's just cheaper to put it to tape.
Sure, and then if you have to restore it, good luck doing that from the cloud in any reasonable time frame.
That's why that's why Amazon came up with their packets. I'm trying to think of the name of the product, but you know, the box of hard drives basically they ship out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it works out. But I don't think that there's going to be a resurgence of Fibre Channel, or not even a resurgence. I think it'll continue to sink fairly rapidly as customers just say, "I'm done with Fibre Channel. Just leave that in the corner. It's fine. It's great. It's whatever." So slowly continuing to sink over the months ahead.
Okay, so that means Brocade's going to have to focus more on the IP networking side, and let's see what they can do there.
Yeah, and of course, people are buying less IP networking. I mean, Cisco's shrinking at 5% in the switching and routing. It's hard to grow against that.
It's a tough world. It's a tough world. Do you have any other financial results you wanted to talk about?
No, F5 had a bad week. One of the analysts said that F5's probably peaked in their share price, and they took their recommendation from a buy to a hold, which is, in other words, stop buying it. It's peaked out. Start thinking about selling it. And they dropped 3 or 4% on the strength of that. So that's not surprising either.
Okay.
Other than that, no, we don't have any more financial news. It was only Cisco and Brocade this week.
Okay. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks want to hear more from you, where can they get it?
You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com, on the Twitter is at etherealmind, and a range of other fine multimedia sites.
Very good. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow me on Twitter at Drew_CM. Thanks to our sponsors, IT Pro TV and Nuage Networks. Please visit our site to find out more about them. And thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook or leave a recommendation on iTunes or share it with your friends. And please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine, and Link Propagation. You can find all those links at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.